Yeah, so our hymn today is Amazing Grace. The normal way of singing it. But I originally, John Newton wrote like 13 verses, and it's a poem about himself. We're not going to sing all 13. I added one that you probably don't know, though, just to give you a sense of, like, the song is longer than I usually sing it. So we're going to sing 5 of the verses, and 4 of them are the common ones, and then the others are not usually sung. I'll read the entire thing when I get to talking through the hymn. But that said, let's sing Amazing Grace. I'm sure you know it. Sure, we understand the theological points and just what he's saying. And yeah, past those are. Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. What's the figure of speech he's using? Anybody know?
He's describing sound.
Voice.
Yeah, what's the sound that he's hearing?
Grace.
Yeah. So just juxtaposition or a. So you don't normally think of hearing grace, right? So, but it makes it's sweet. And obviously, grace, the main theological concept to Christianity. What's the definition of grace? Just so we know as we're moving forward.
Squirrel.
Not really.
Drawing compassion from a higher place. Higher place being like a.
All right.
Higher moral ground or
mercy undeserved.
Yeah.
Mercy undeserved, showing compassion from a higher authority to a subordinate. Yeah, okay. And I like those. Yeah, the general churchy answer, unmerited favor, right? Undeserved mercy. Yeah, grace is not getting what you deserve. And I would even say that that applies to when you get something bad that you don't do to bring upon yourself. That's still grace from God. Pain is a means of bringing about sanctification and a measure of grace. Most people don't think of it that way, but I do. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. What biblical story is he referencing? One of Clint's favorites.
Well, is it
Solomon? No,
it's the one
with Solomon.
Which is
the one where they called him in?
Yeah.
And said, were you even actually blind?
Yeah, Jesus heals the blind man, and then the Pharisees call him in and call his parents in, and all he says is, look, all I know is I was blind, but now I see. Who healed you? Jesus. Even though he says, don't tell anybody that I healed you. But, that's the biblical story he's referencing, this famous line. And then what theological concept is he talking about? I once was lost, but now I'm found. Okay, yeah, adopted into the fold of Christ. More generally speaking, or more directly speaking?
Saved,
yeah, salvation. Regeneration, the entire process of salvation. I saw one hanging on a tree in agonies and blood who fixed his languid eyes on me as near his cross I stood.
What does languid mean?
Languid means sorrowful and passionate. Usually it means like despairing, sort of. Think of something languid as being in agony.
Because we languish.
Exactly.
So it's like I'm in despair, but it's because you sort of.
What?
It's like I'm looking at you like I'm doing this for you.
Yeah, that's the context here for sure. Who's he talking about?
Squirrel.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that one's easy. "'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved." What does he mean by fear? Fear. "'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear." What's his heart fearing? Possibly. "And grace my fears relieved." What's he talking about?
He taught him to fear for his salvation.
Okay, so what did you say, Caleb, down here?
More like death.
Death, fearing death. And you said
like hell, I guess.
Okay. And what you were talking about?
Well, fearing death. You know,
hope that
he's safe. So it's
same kind of thing. And you said fearing God. Which you could argue is kind of the same thing, since hell is given as a punishment from God. He created hell, just FYI. It's not like he's not in control of what goes on in hell. He is. So, yeah, I'd say both are correct. I lean towards more specifically he's talking about just the fear of God. 'Twas grace that taught me to fear God, because in our natural state, exactly. Like, I learned the fear of God because he is awesome, mighty, and powerful. And again, hell is included in that. But in grace, my fear is relieved. He learned of the love of God and the kindness of God that relieves that fear. How precious did that grace appear when the hour I first believed? What's he reflecting on? Again. Salvation, yeah, that was the moment of salvation. The Lord hath promised good to me, his word my hope secures. He will my shield and portion be as long as life endures.
Resurrection of the Holy Spirit.
Resurrection of the Holy Spirit. Definitely the my hope secures. What hope is he securing? Securing the promise of resurrection. Yes. What verse might he be thinking of? What the Lord has promised good to me?
Jeremiah.
Okay, he might be thinking of that. What else might he be thinking of that would be theologically accurate?
The Lord hath promised good to me.
Yeah.
Eternal life.
Yeah, that's probably the concept he has. But what verse is he thinking of? Where did God promise good to him?
Somewhere in the Bible.
Somewhere in the Bible. Yeah. So if we're going with he's thinking about the promise of eternal life. I mean, you just got like John 3:16. Sure. If he's thinking, I think he's talking more about general living the daily day to day life. Good is promised to him. Shield and portion be. I'm thinking Romans 8, right? God works all things together for the good of those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. I think that's a theologically accurate statement to say that God has promised good to me, and he's expressing his own love for God. I think that's fair. When we've been there 10,000 years, bright, shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. What theological concept is he describing?
When we're singing God's praises with him. New Jerusalem.
Right. New Jerusalem, resurrection, and eternity. And I love the way that puts it in perspective. We've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. What's he saying?
We'll live forever.
Yeah. It's going to go on forever. So when we started, however long we've been doing it, guess what? We've got just as many days doing it later after that point because it's eternal. Nice poetic way of putting it. This is the whole poem. So listen and feel free to Google it. That's how I found this, by the way. So quick Google search. You guys don't have it. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found, was blind, but now I see. In evil, long I took delight, unawed by shame or fear, till a new object met my sight and stopped my wild career. I saw one hanging on a tree in agonies and blood, who fixed his languid eyes on me as near his cross I stood. Sure, never till my latest breath can I forget that look. It seemed to change me with his death, though not a word I spoke. My conscience owned and felt the guilt and plunged me in despair. I saw my sins his blood has shed and helped to nail him there. Alas, I knew not what I did, but all my tears were vain. Where could my trembling soul be hid for the Lord I had slain? A second look he gave, which said, I freely all forgive. This blood is for thy ransom paid. I die that thou mayest live. 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace appear the hour I first believed. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Tis grace hath brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. The Lord has promised good to me. His word my hope secures. He will my shield and portion be as long as life endures. Yes, when this flesh and heart shall fail and mortal life shall cease, I shall possess within the veil a life of joy and peace. The earth shall soon dissolve like snow, the sun forbear to shine, but God who called me here below shall be forever mine. When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. So there's a whole section describing in more detail the conversion process that he went through of that poem. They usually left out when we're singing because it's first person and all that. But to make a little bit more sense of that section of the poem, we'll learn a little bit about John Newton. Does anybody know anything about John Newton already? All right.
I've seen the movie Amazing Grace, but...
Okay. So yeah, he's in there.
Oh, yeah. It wasn't just about John
Newton. Yeah. It was mainly about William Wolverforce, though. Yeah. So.
Are fake Newtons connected to him anyway?
I don't think so.
That would be awesome.
Cookies. This guy's a rebel.
Oh, we got a three fig Newton eater. John Newton was born in Wapping, London, in 1725, the son of John Newton Sr., a shipmaster in Mediterranean service. In 1743, while going to visit friends, Newton was captured and pressed into the naval service by the Royal Navy. He became a midshipman aboard HMS Harwich. At one point, Newton tried to desert and was punished in front of the crew of 350. Stripped to the waist and tied to the grating, he received a flogging of 8 dozen lashes and reduced to the rank of a common seaman. You guys know what pressed means? You're pressed into the naval service.
Of course. Drafted.
Yeah, drafted. Back then, drafting was a little bit more forceful, violent. There were press gangs who would literally just walk around the streets and just grab people and capture them and force them to go into the Navy right then and there. It's not like you got to, you know, go home and say goodbye to your loved ones and that sort of thing. It was, we grab you and we put you on a ship and you can't go anywhere because you're out at sea. So you're going to serve in the Navy. Kind of paragraph. Following that disgrace and humiliation, Newton initially contemplated murdering the captain and committing suicide by throwing himself overboard. But later, Harwich, en route to India, he was transferred to Pegasus, a slave ship bound for West Africa. The ship carried goods to Africa and traded them for slaves to be shipped to the colonies in the Caribbean and North America. Newton did not get along with the crew of Pegasus. In 1745, they left him in West Africa with Amos Clow, a slave dealer, who made him a house slave. Newton later recounted this period as the time he was once an infidel and libertine, a servant of slaves in West Africa. Early in 1748, he was rescued by a sea captain who had been asked by Newton's father to search for him and returned to England on the merchant ship Greyhound. During his 1748 voyage to England after his rescue, Newton had a spiritual conversion. The ship encountered a severe storm off the coast of Donegal, Ireland, and almost sank. Newton marked this experience as the beginning of his conversion to evangelical Christianity. He began to read the Bible and other religious literature. By the time he reached Britain, he had accepted the doctrines of evangelical Christianity. The date was 10 March 1748, an anniversary he marked for the rest of his life. From that point on, he avoided profanity, gambling, and drinking. Although he continued to work in the slave trade, he had gained sympathy for the slaves during his time in Africa. He later said that his true conversion did not happen until some time later. I cannot consider myself to have been a believer in the full sense of the word until a considerable time afterwards. In 1750, Newton married his childhood sweetheart, Mary Catlett, in St. Margaret's Church, Rochester. From 1757 to 1790, he pursued the priesthood and rigorous education in the Christian faith, learning ancient languages and eventually attaining the degree Doctor of Divinity and the role of Anglican priest. As a priest, he befriended many in Parliament, including William Wilberforce, leader of the abolitionist campaign in England. Wilberforce credited Newton with being a strong spiritual influence on him, who encouraged him to stay in the Parliament when he considered quitting, and acted as a form of support during his abolition efforts. So, long story short, Newton was a slave. He was a slave trader after being a slave, and he was ultimately involved in ending slavery in Europe. Interesting little twist there. Newton published the hymn Amazing Grace in 1779, though he wrote it as a sermon illustration in 1773. To this day, it is widely regarded the most well-known hymn of all time, largely because of its memorable tune, powerful emotion, and simple but clear statement of the central doctrines of Christianity, among them the one mentioned by the Apostle Paul in Ephesians 2:8, "We are saved by grace through faith, not by works of the law." So that is John Newton and Amazing Grace.
Taken largely from Wikipedia articles on John Newton.
Indeed. Usually what I do is I just copy and paste huge chunks of those paragraphs and then just edit and smooth them out with my own words. So, not my work at all. Definitely plagiarized, and I would be fined heavily if I profited at all from this in any way.
But you know, a lot of people don't get how copyrights work.
Yeah.
So what movie are we watching?
We're not actually watching a movie today. We are watching a few clips, though, to sort of
help us.
Yeah, we're doing our lesson, how to watch a movie today. Does anybody need a pen?
Should we watch a movie next time, then? And take notes?
Possibly, I'd doubt for that. We can
decide. How to watch a movie. We can actually watch a movie.
Or we can mark
watch anybody else
the movie
pen?
Afterwards.
I do have my pen.
There's the handouts for how to watch a movie. You may want them today. I think more than any other day, this would be one where taking notes would be helpful. Because there's going to be sections where we just discuss, and it's nice to write down what we discussed. I forgot to put my little logo on this one.
Yeah, well, in that case, anyway. Then I will take a pen.
You will take a pen. Anybody else need a pen?
Yes, so far.
Okay. So yes, today we are talking about how to watch a movie. Hey Cameron, could you grab me a bottle of water? My throat's already starting to itch, which is not a good sign.
What do you want, some water?
I'll take it to the bottle.
So today we're talking about how to watch a movie, and obviously part of this is my opinion on how to watch a movie, but also it's the opinion that I think is biblically based, informed by reason, Christian thought, and other such things. I think it's a good opinion to follow and have. But this is not a, here's exactly what the Bible says on how to watch a movie, because the Bible doesn't really say anything on how to watch a movie. Movies weren't really a thing back then. The closest thing they had were plays, and they didn't talk about it at all in the Bible, so we don't really have much to go on in that realm. So this is where we have to do our own theology, taking what the Bible says and trying to apply it correctly. And honestly, I didn't really take any Bible verses out to put in this PowerPoint presentation. We're talking more concepts that we as Bible-believing Christians would agree on and can probably think of support pretty readily if we were to just give it a second. But here's the outline for the day. We're going to talk briefly about worldviews. We talked about it in here some. I know some haven't talked about worldviews with us. So talk about what a worldview is, because worldviews are what make a movie. And then we're going to start talking about some of the nerdier things, components of a movie, what goes into making a movie, how does it work? I, as somebody who wanted to be a filmmaker for a long time and had done a lot of amateur filmmaking, am interested in that sort of thing. But I want you guys to think about the components and everything that goes into making a movie, because the people who made the movie did. And everything that they used to make the movie, they used for a reason. They rarely put something into a movie just because. So, we'll talk about that. Then we're going to talk about the questions to ask of a movie. How do you analyze a movie? How do you think through some of the things in a movie? And then we're going to practice it. We're going to watch two short films that you might have seen. They both kind of went viral at one point. And then we're going to watch one scene from Frasier that I like. No. Just a short clip from Frasier, but... Anyway, the idea will be to practice it, and I'm curious to know what you guys think and say about that. So I want engagement in the discussion part when we get there, and we'll give some final thoughts. So that's where we're headed. Be with me on where we're headed. We'll go quick on the worldview stuff, because I think it's pretty straightforward, and we've talked about it a lot in this group, and if you don't know much about worldviews, haven't thought about it, I would recommend going back and listening to some of the worldview episodes, back in like the story of the Bible and that sort of thing. But what is a worldview, anyone? Can you offer possibly a definition?
So I think a worldview is the set of beliefs by which each person, subconsciously observes and interprets the world.
That's pretty accurate. I think that's a pretty good definition to work off of.
Let me get Webster's in there.
on what a worldview is. This is my personal definition. Thank you. Yeah, hold your applause. A worldview is a set of beliefs by which each person subconsciously observes and interprets the world. It's how do you see the world? Christians see the world a certain way. Ideally, you see it through the lens of this book. You see it as one big unfolding story of which we are a part, somewhere right around there is where we are in the story. Starts in a garden with the first man and the first woman and progresses toward a city in which the same plant that was in that garden resides in that city at the end. Sorry for the double preposition there. Components of a worldview. How do you break it down and think about it, though? Everybody has a worldview. Everybody thinks about these things at some point in their lives. They think about God. They think about ethics and morality. They think about evil. They think about reality, knowledge, and truth. And everybody thinks something about these things. Even if your something is, I don't think that thing exists. Which many people today would say. They would argue that God, truth, and morality don't exist. Almost everyone recognizes that one exists. There are very few aponeiros people, absence of evil. It doesn't happen. Because evil is just so in your face, particularly in our current culture. Anybody remember a particular act of evil that occurred recently?
Vegas.
Man. Don't even have to elaborate very much. We all know what you're talking about, right?
Jeremy was in Vegas when that happened.
He was right down the street.
Oh.
Jeremy.
But evil is obviously present. You have to explain it somehow. What is it? Is it some sort of eternally existing force that's equal and opposite to some good force that eternally exists? And they're constantly at war in the universe and will always be at war? That would be called dualism. That's like the Star Wars view of evil and good.
The yin and the yang.
They complement and balance each other. That's not the Christian view. The Christian view is that evil had a beginning, and it will have an end. That sort of thing. I'm going to trust that you guys are thinking people and can think about these things and what you believe on each of them. What do you think about God, ethics, morality, evil, reality? How do you think about those things? And we're going to move on from that. But worldview is very much tied to how do you watch a movie, because every movie has a worldview, or the makers of that movie have a worldview. Side note, quick little thing about art. Is anybody here interested in art?
Define interested.
Did you say art?
Art.
No.
So, music, paintings, sculptures, movies. Movies are art.
Interested how? Like, interested as in enjoy?
Enjoy it, yeah.
Or just, like, enjoy.
Yeah, enjoy consuming it,
more
listening to it, watching it, seeing it.
So every form of creation is art.
Yeah, I think so. I would say art is a form of creation that contains a message. That would be my rough definition of art.
Matthew's to be art.
I was on board with any form of creation.
That's. Just personally, I see, like, movies and, like, not all movies, of course, because some movies are just meant for entertainment, they're not really art. Because to me, art is meant to inspire, and
Okay.
Well, historically, some art sucks.
I agree. I'm going to put this out a little bit more because I'm going to hear more of you guys today. But I want to push back a little bit on two things you just said. Okay. One is you said, to me, art is meant to inspire.
That's what I think.
Yeah, so does that mean that art is meant to inspire? Objectively, like, art, if you didn't exist, would art still be meant to inspire?
No, please. I mean, no, what is art? If I didn't exist, well, to many other people, less.
Okay, so what you're saying is, yes, an aspect of art is that it's meant to inspire.
But what inspires is different form.
What is art without existence to admire it? Is it still art, or is it just existence?
Just a little bit of a pushback there. On I would agree. Part of art's purpose is to inspire.
Well,
it's just the way you talk about it.
No, I'm saying like that. It seems like that's its main purpose. Usually, is because you know every great artist you listen to, like you kind of read some of the things they've said, and usually that's their main talking point is about inspiration.
What are you saying? If it doesn't inspire you wouldn't consider it art?
No. He's just saying its purpose. The main purpose of art is to inspire. I would agree with postmodern art. I think you might be a little bit anachronistic. If you go down through art throughout the centuries, the purpose of art the main purpose of art has shifted. You look at the Renaissance.
Egypt.
The main purpose of art was to teach.
Back in Egypt, it was meant to communicate.
In Egypt, it was meant to communicate. Yeah. So there are different purposes for art, and some of them have more prominence in different ages than others. So good.
It was also used to push on social agendas.
Correct. Yeah. Lots of times it's used to inspire towards action on a certain topic.
Sounds stupid, but like memes today.
Yes, I'd say memes are a form of art today.
Those are inspirational.
And so we're going to talk about what makes good art and what's bad art, because I think that there is an objective way that you can measure that, or at least start to quantify it and not measure it. But we'll get there. But so that's more broad, and we're going to talk a little bit about more specifically how do movies fit into that genre of art and what makes it a good movie or a bad movie. And one of the ways is to talk about the components of a movie. So all movies are made up of components, pieces. Different things come together to make a movie. To give you a few examples to get your brain working, actors, directors, producers are components of a movie. Lights, sound, CGI are components of a movie. A script, a story with a story arc and a plot, these are components of a movie. Genre and tone are components of a movie. The general feeling that the movie creates in the viewer is a component of the movie. Something that they're putting into it or trying to get out of it. So the question, how do we organize all of these things, these components of a movie? And so I've given you a few that I came up with, ways to organize the components of a movie. Example, creators and what is created. One way to organize all the components is to separate the creator of the art or the movie from the art or the movie that he creates. So writers, directors, producers, actors, musicians, people who are creating, and then what they create. Story, script, music, characters, plot, sound, CGI effects. Where this organization method sort of leaves things out would be things like the inanimate object, like a light fixture. Technically, the person who created that light fixture probably wasn't creating it for the movie or to communicate something in the movie or to contribute to the art. So this is where trying to organize all these things, you're going to lose a few in your organization method, so I'm giving you a few. Pieces in the whole would be another way you could try and organize these things in your mind. Pieces like actors, lights, scripts, characters, climax, cameras, versus the whole, the thing that it produces at the end. The story, the meaning, the message, and the lesson. The plot, the tone, the genre. These would be things that are described from the whole finished product as opposed to the pieces or components that make up that product. Another way you might think about and organize these ideas would be in the production of a movie, pre-production, production, and post-production. kind of like blueprints, the skeleton, and then the finished product.
Yeah.
Pre-production would be script, story, genres, writers, producers, the guys who are coming up with the idea for how to make the movie but not yet making it. Production would be the things used in making the movie, lights, cameras, directors. Some of these would go in multiple categories, right? The actors or the writers might be involved in both pre-production and production. And then post-production, CGI, editing, the final story arc is determined in post-production. What do we cut? What do we keep? The tone usually is determined in post-production. How are we going to... What effect do we want to leave in the minds and hearts of our viewers? Another way that I thought of was actors, or active components versus passive components. This one picture sums up active and passive components nicely. What is the active component in this picture? It's a picture of a man holding a gun, and we assume he looks sinister. He's in the act of doing a mass shooting. What's the active component?
The man.
What's the passive component? The gun. Right. The gun is inanimate. It doesn't take action. It is acted upon. Or it is acted with, but it doesn't take its own action. Whereas the man is the one who takes the action. He's the active component. So this would be kind of translating the movie world. There are active components. Actors, writers, directors, story, is this an active component or a passive component? This is like what you produce. So this, again, things falling through the cracks. Versus passive components, the lights, the cameras, the props, the CGI, the tools that you use to make the movie. You guys sort of with me on how I want you thinking? These are all the things that go into making a movie. Any other, which one of these do you like? How do you best like to categorize the components of a movie, what goes into it. Speak.
Number one.
Number one. Creators and what's created. I don't think any of them are wrong or any of them are right. I tend to agree. I think that the creators and what's created, I like that way of thinking about it. But there are things that fall through the cracks with that one. Any other thoughts or ideas of how to categorize the components of a movie? Or even, have you even thought about the fact that all these components go into a movie? When you go to the theater, do you ever think, okay, who's in here? Who directed this? Or do you ever walk out going, man, the lighting in there was just, like they used that well to make a point.
No.
See, this is where we're film nerds like myself. That's what I'm doing all the time. I'm walking out, like Blade Runner. Hated that movie overall, but they did awesome stuff with lighting. Dark Knight, same thing. Christopher Nolan is better with lighting than any other director currently making movies. He just knows how to cast a shadow on a screen to make a point, and you can see it in certain scenes in The Dark Knight where it's just like, oh, he did that on purpose. Like, there's symbolism right there, and he's using his lights to work for it.
I'll catch a little bit of symbolism, but I mostly just sit and watch the movie to enjoy it.
Yeah. So here's the thing. The people making the movie are making those choices intentionally. They're the crazy people like me, well, not like me, who've gone to film school, but they've gone to film school probably, and they've been taught every single component is there for a purpose, and you're using it to communicate something. Example, a movie that I hate is the Bourne movies, the whole trilogy. I hate those movies for one reason, and it's a stylistic choice. It's the shaky cam. The whole movie, they're pretty much never using a tripod. It's always like a guy, and the camera's shaking all around, and it's supposed to give you that feeling of being in the action, right? All those fight scenes, the throwing punches, and the camera's just like jumping all over the place.
It's really hard to watch.
Yeah. Gives me a headache. I don't like the movie for that reason. But it was an intentional choice by the director. He was trying to elicit an emotion from his audience to make you feel like you're part of the action. Right? These things are always happening in movies. The directors and the producers and the cinematographers are thinking about these things, even if you're not. And the good ones, like you've expressed, communicate the ideas without you realizing that they've communicated it. They're trying to implant their message in your brain without you realizing that they did it. That's what makes a good movie. You walk out of there and you think, you just have an emotional reaction, or you walk out thinking about one particular thing and you don't really know why, you just know that that's what you got out of the movie. If you can walk out of there and there's like, see that scene where he said this, and then the camera switched over and was close up on this guy's face, and I just started thinking of a John Mulaney sketch in my mind, but if you can break down the components, usually that's a sign that it's a bad movie, or not well done, right? These are things that I think you should be thinking about when you're watching a movie. You should be looking for the components. First of all, certain components are always present. Any movie, there's going to be certain components that are there. And these are the four that I came up with that are always, if you have a movie, these four things are part of that movie. Writer, director, camera, message, and meaning. And the message or meaning might be, we have no message. This is just... yeah, exactly. This is just stupid comedy. Those are usually some of my favorite movies. But Spinal Tap, yeah. But even then, there's sub-points, sub-plot points where they're making a statement. They're trying to... They're doing something.
They emphasize friendship a lot throughout the movie. Like,
there you go.
At the end, too.
Yeah. The whole band reunites. You even have Ian back there with the cricket bat at the end. And then the drummer blows up, yeah. A thinking Christian takes note of the components in a movie that he's watching. This is a statement that I'm putting out there. I think that this is true. I think if you're thinking and you're a Christian, you should be taking notes of the components of the movie that you're watching. You should recognize when a point is being made. Not just be sucked in. Take out the point. And so, with all that in mind, there are certain questions that every Christian should ask of a movie. And the main one to ask, the one that if you don't walk away from anything with this lesson other than this, this is what I want you to get. What is the point, main idea, or message of this movie? Or you could replace art with that. Every form of art. Writing, music, painting, sculpture. Every form of art has a point that the artist wanted to communicate, a main idea or a message. Preaching, same thing. This is what you learn in Preaching 101, is your sermon should have a main idea, and everything in your sermon should be supporting or pointing to that main idea. And a good sermon is one where you can walk away and in one sentence say, what was that sermon about? Well, yeah, it was about Christians should tithe 10% of their income. It may be a right point or a wrong point, but it had a point. And so I want you guys to develop the skill of identifying the point. What is the main idea, the message, or the point of any art, or in this case, any movie that you consume? Be able to state that point in a single sentence. Make sure it is a complete sentence with a subject and a complement. Like here's an example. Here's a form of art, newspaper, writing. What's the main idea of this article without having read it?
Except when it blew up.
Yeah. You could even say, Hindenburg blast kills 35 people. That's the main point of the article. Like, think of it as a newspaper title of an article.
I was going to say, the blast was that one guy's fault.
Yeah. Subtitle, explosion blamed on this guy. So, this is obviously internet... trolling, because that's not historically accurate. But point is, you should be able to state what the art is about in a single sentence. And if you think of it like what's the headline for this newspaper article, that this art form or a newspaper article, what would be the headline? That's a good way to identify what's the main point. What's the reason for this art? Also. When you're sitting around trying to think of the main idea of a movie or an art form, try to be objective and put yourself in the place of the creator. What point are they trying to convey? Not Not yet. What do I think about this point? Just what point are they trying to make? So, give you an example or practice with this. You guys heard the song "Shake It Off," yeah?
Yes.
Taylor Swift.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I know we hate it, but we know the song, right?
No.
So
we
put yourself
to make sure that we all know it.
Put yourself in the place of Taylor Swift. What point? What main idea is she trying to communicate with that song?
Shake off the haters,
bro. Shake off the haters
with a Z.
Shake off the haters, bro, with a Z. All right, good. Yeah, I think that's. And what define what we mean by shake off?
Don't listen to them.
Get them off of you.
Yeah, don't listen to the haters. So, in a complete single sentence, it might be the point of shake it off is do not allow the detractors in your life to shape your perception of your life. Yeah? Point of action. This is what she's saying. Don't let it happen. What would the point of this lesson be?
We gotta watch a movie.
Yeah. To give you some things of how to go about this process, identifying the main idea, these are some other questions you can ask. Ask yourself, why was this movie made? And this kind of gets back to what we were talking about earlier. Was it made to inform, to inspire, to entertain, to lament? What was the main reason or purpose that they made this piece of art? If it's to inform, it's going to have a different sort of feel, tone, than if it's to entertain. Right? When you're watching Ken Burns' Civil War, great documentary, but its purpose is to inform. So it feels very different when you're watching that movie than when you're watching Zoolander. That one's to inform, too, about the world of modeling, but more so to entertain, even though you learn a lot about the world of modeling from that movie. Yeah, it's pretty hilarious. Asking the worldview of the movie. What is this movie saying about the world, reality, morality? And starting to transition into, after you've identified the main point, start asking, is this main point correct? And what do you compare it to figure out if this main point is correct or true? This one's easy. The Bible. Yeah. Source of revelation from God. We've talked a lot in here about truth. Where do you get it? I would argue that you get it from here. If it contradicts what's in here, it's wrong. So, the Bible. Transitioning away from the identifying the main idea and evaluating it, asking questions of, is this good art? What makes good art? I would say what makes a movie good or what makes good art is if its form matches its function. Do the components of the movie facilitate the message that it's producing? Two examples to juxtapose this so you can get the idea. A horror movie making a statement about the nature of evil. Form matches function. Yeah, a horror movie is a good function to talk about evil, because that's usually what horror movies are about. That's kind of the whole point of the genre, is look, evil on display, let's say something about the nature of evil. Form matches function there. One where form doesn't quite match function as well would be a Pixar movie about the Holocaust. Yeah. Right? Pixar movies are generally family-friendly, lighter, they're a little bit funny, and have a happy-go-lucky sort of love one another sort of tone. Holocaust is not really that sort of a story to tell.
I would laugh at every joke and feel bad for it.
Yeah.
Anne Frank movie.
You understand what I'm saying about form and function? Could somebody give me another example of like when form and function don't match versus when they do?
Action movie. Talking about
because the movie that came to mind was Minority Report, and in that movie, just every single ad is about this one brand of water. That's just what I remember.
Okay, yeah, whenever you see advertising in a movie, and they don't do it well, right? It's just like, it's like when you watch the Avengers movie, it's like, wow, everyone drives a Chevy. Who knew? That would be an example where the components didn't facilitate the message very well. It was in your face, right? They drew attention to the components instead of drawing attention to the message.
Yeah, or like the new Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Supposed to be about, oh, we're all equal. Okay.
Yeah, taking a well-established story and just changing the sexes of the characters for no reason at all. Like what they're about to do with Lord of the Flies.
Which makes no
sense. Makes no sense, exactly. Because little boys left on an island to themselves are going to behave slightly differently than little girls left on an island to themselves. It's just the reality of it.
Not even slightly.
Little girls are as tough as little boys.
Yeah.
They're tougher than little boys, didn't you hear? We're equal.
Please say that.
As swords of Frenchie.
You understand where I'm going with form and function. This can sometimes be used intentionally. I'm going to make a movie whose form doesn't match its function to make a point. An example of that recently, a movie that was terrible, and I do not recommend you watching, but the Sausage Party, right? That animated movie that was incredibly sexually graphic and disgusting, but the whole point was like, ha ha ha, we're taking the normal form of a children's movie and making it like really, really adult. So they specifically mismatched form and function to make a point. Sometimes that can be the message, is that your components are not facilitating the message. And so that is your message. These are things I want you thinking about when you're watching a movie. Finally, does this movie reflect reality? This is something you as a Christian should always be asking. And this is kind of where the analysis ends with watching a movie. Is what they're saying, is their message true? What I'm really getting at. Are these characters true to life? Or if it doesn't match reality, if the characters are unrealistic, are they unrealistic for a purpose? This makes good art, if they're true to life, or if they're unrealistic for a purpose. Avengers being an example. Like, the whole point is that they're superheroes. They're not normal people. So it works. Whereas we've all seen movies with terrible actors or bad dialogue where the characters were not true to life. It's like, nobody would actually respond that way. This is a bad movie.
Oh, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Daredevil.
Yeah.
When they run into the forest instead of seeing...
Yeah. Everybody with me? Things that I think you should be thinking about when you're watching a movie? Last one, what methods do the makers use to make their case? So after they've made their point, sit back and think, what are their supporting arguments? How are they doing it? Think back on what you've learned in English class, probably about the three types of argument. It comes from Plato, pathos, ethos, and logos. Anybody know those?
It's a path to your heart. It's the logic, and it's the
path to ethos.
It's
like appealing to your ethics.
I don't remember
right.
What logos is.
So, yeah, emotion... At morality and logic. Those are the three ways to make an argument. What?
For whatever reason, pathos just sounds like it should be.
Yeah, same root word. But those are the three types of arguments you can make. You can make a moral argument, as in we're going to argue that morality itself dictates you should behave that way. That should always yield the question, where did the morality come from? Just FYI. But
there was like this whole debate thing, and in every single one of my comments I made sure I said, yes, morality exists if you accept free will, because if you reject free will then you reject morality.
You sound like Ben Shapiro. Pathos would be the emotional arguments, emotional appeals. You guys have heard these, yes? Whenever you watch the SPCA movies, where Sarah McLachlan comes on, in the arms of the angel, and then you see all of the dogs with, they're obviously frowning somehow into the camera, with the big eyes, and they're like, adopt me or they're going to slaughter us all. This is an emotional appeal. This is not a logical appeal. Right? It's tugging on the heartstrings.
I don't know. I never felt anything else.
Yeah, sometimes the pathos arguments fall flat. Logos would be the ones built on logical reasons. Those are usually the ones that get accused of being heartless. I'm well-versed with being accused of being heartless. I think those are the best arguments. The ones based on logic and the ones based on morality, ethics, and I think that the emotional arguments usually detract from an argument instead of adding to it, but should not be completely ignored. They should be recognized and appropriately placed into a box. Anyway. Music, pictures, characters. These are some of the other ways that they're supporting their argument. Does the character behave a certain way that elicits a certain response or makes a certain point? We're going to see an example of that, a couple examples, I think. Lighting, sound, camera, angles, again, those are things that more that the film school nerds would recognize more than regular people. But I think it's something that worth training your eye to look for. Example of one, so you guys remember the Dark Knight? In that scene when Batman's standing on the roof with Harvey Dent and Commissioner Gordon, and they're doing that circle shot. You remember that? They're having this whole conversation going back and forth, the three of them, and the camera is circling around the outside of them as they're talking. And so the dialogue usually lines up to whoever's facing the camera is the one speaking. But it's this really cool scene, one single shot, circling around them. And the effect is kind of like what the camera is doing. You're listening to this. Can we get a prosecutor? Yes, we can. Can she do it? No, Batman, can you get the evidence? And they're going back and forth. And it creates this sort of like swirling sort of, it's building sort of effect. The way that the camera is swirling and building, it builds, creates tension. As opposed to, instead of just having stationary shots where we cut to the person talking, it's less active. It stirs up the viewer less than seeing this moving shot while they're talking. That sort of stuff usually goes unnoticed, but is there to make a point. It's there to do something to the viewer.
We could watch that scene.
Yeah, I just thought of it on the spot. Otherwise, I would have included it. But
you can probably find it on YouTube.
Yeah, we can do that at the end. I think I got time for everything that I wanted to do. So. We're going to practice on two short films and a scene from Frasier. So, I want you all to watch these two short films and answer these four questions. So you have your sheet. This is the third page. This is where you're going to probably want a pen. Let me make sure my sound is working.
Hey, camera. Yeah, you should turn down the lights. I would, but I'm too far away.
Hey, Jerry, you want to turn down the lights? You know how to do the slider so they don't go all the way off so people can still see to right? But
this one, this slider?
I think so.
No. No. Yes.
Come on. This should work. Alright, so this first short film is called The Present. It's a short film produced by Jacob Frey. Ideally, whenever you're watching a movie, it's good to know something about the people who made the movie. So if you're going to see a movie made by a particular director or producer or written by a particular writer, knowing something about their worldview helps you to analyze the film that you're watching. But all you know right now is this guy's name. And so part of this exercise is ideally also, after having watched a piece of art, you should be able to tell something about the person who made the art. Maybe tell a little bit about what his worldview is. So this is a short film called The Present.
Oh, I've seen this one before.
Yeah, and I'm going to go just load it.
It's very moving.
Yeah, it's not working quite right.
That was part of the stylistic choice.
Yeah. Right? If that were working correctly, it would have been. Let's watch what that is. Oh, sorry.
Wrong one.
monster.
Maybe it's just because of how it downloaded. Okay, sorry, we're gonna have to go watch it online.
It's on YouTube.
Yeah.
Also, your computer seems to be kind of freezing up and going glitchy.
I think you're right, it's thinking it's my computer. Disconnecting and reconnecting.
The Flash, that's a pretty good show. That's pretty good. I don't know. I'm on my page. I don't know. I don't know. You watch it?
Come on.
It's pretty good. It's a good show. Where did you finish the season?
Here we go. Let's go. Okay. In one sentence, what's the creator's message point?
Being disabled is hard.
Okay. Very possible. I think that's a good starting place. So let's hold off on that question and talk about some of the components we saw, and then see how the components add up to make a point or a message. What are some of the components you saw?
Both the dog and the boy were missing taste.
A lot of pathos.
There you go. There's a pathos thing of argument. There's both the dog and the boy are missing a limb. That's definitely a component of the story. Sorry. Climax would be when you stand up and see the boy is missing a leg also. Right? What are some other components you saw?
Lighting.
There was lighting, right? In the beginning, it's dark. There's war sounds going on. And then she opens a window, opens the shades to a window. And I don't know, on that note, at the end, there's a lot of credits. What's standing open?
The door.
The door, right? Symbolism there, right? The door is open now as opposed to closed, shut in. He's more free. What else did you see? There is a giraffe. Good observation. It's a component.
Two wildly different, perspectives or attitudes towards their circumstances.
There you go.
So opposing sides.
Attitudes towards circumstances. I think that you just touched on the main point of this movie. I would summarize it here and see if you can edit it or make it a little bit better. I'm going to say the main point of this movie was your situation is only as bad as your outlook, and a better outlook contains a brighter future than a pessimistic outlook.
Also, that people need companionship and something to relate to.
There you go. An aspect of companionship, friendship. People are meant to be in community.
Someone or something can always affect you in a positive way so as to change your negative outlook.
Good, all right. So someone or something can always change your outlook to be more positive. And the argument, obviously, is it's better. Yeah. Start out, he's surly and frowning. At the end, he's smiling.
So.
Silly surly.
And it's just like, what? It's a rigged snake, don't worry.
Another one is, your mom always knows best.
Yeah, and your mom always knows best. These would be sub points supporting the main point. What do you think is the creator's worldview? What does he think about God, ethics, morality, reality, truth, knowledge? I think those last three are more attainable from this short film. What does he think about reality?
Probably thinks it's a positive if you look for it. That you can change your reality based on your attitude. Like,
I would almost say the opposite.
Well, really?
So he recognized reality is what it is.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, so reality can be tough and reality is tough.
That's why I said your reality, not...
Yeah, so you're...
Because the reality that you perceive. Like that he was in a dark place, he was shut in from the world, and then he was brought out of it because of a companion.
Yeah.
And so his
the only thing that can change is your own perspective.
Yeah.
Not the reality of the situation you're in.
The reality
was that's positive.
Yeah, good. Okay. Yeah, I would agree. Does the form match the function?
Yes. Well, yes and no. Because on one hand, it has more of a Pixar type of look, but it has deeper meaning than what you're used to.
Right. Yeah, this is something that's particularly common in short films. Short films, particularly nowadays, are more often animated. One, because it's cheaper to animate a short film than to film a short film. And two, because you can make them do more fantastic things on a smaller budget. Again, cheaper. But you can bring in more fantastic concepts and better symbolism in an animated film than you can with a live-action film. What's the biblical analysis response to this film? So we kind of identified the main point. We could probably refine it further. We have more time. But the main point was something along the lines of positive people in your community change your outlook and is therefore better in dire situations. Go ahead. Would you say that that's a
change your outlook and attitude towards your reality?
Towards your reality.
Doesn't even need to be
while
here,
still recognizing the truth.
While still recognizing the truth. So would you say that that is a biblical point to be made? That's a good and true point.
Yeah,
say, generally speaking,
I don't have any biblical evidence off the top of my head, but generally speaking, yes, I would say all positive things.
I would say yes, generally speaking, yes. If the point that this creator is making is saying, your perception shapes reality, then we as Christians would deny that. We'd say no. Reality is objective. The only thing that is shaped is your perception. The reality doesn't change. But I think that this guy was not saying that. Good. All right, here's another one. Another short film. Let me know what you think of this one.
Thank you.
Alright. What are some of the components you saw? What were some of the messages and themes?
Well, that love is only something you feel for someone you're sexually attracted to.
Alright. Yeah, there you go. Okay, so what I want to very specifically do, we want to put our place in the put ourselves in the place of the creators of this film first. Accurately represent their point. What is their main point? Okay? At the end, we evaluate whether or not it's a true, right, or biblical point. Alright? So let's start with that, and I agree, but let's keep the sarcasm out of it to start with, okay?
That so. Some boys love other boys, and a lot of people don't like that.
Okay.
But if you go for it, and that other boy likes you...
It's good.
Don't be ashamed to follow your heart.
There you go. Okay, don't be ashamed to follow your heart. It might be one way to... Your feelings aren't something you can control. I think these are good stabs at what's the main point or the message. You can summarize it with the old adage, the heart wants what it wants.
Whatever your heart wants is okay.
Let's back up off of the main point and analyze some of the components to begin with. What was the main symbol? Like, the symbolism was pretty blatant in this one. It wasn't as subtle.
At the beginning, when he was walking by, he was throwing the apple, and it kind of symbolized that he was the apple of his eye.
Okay, good.
And then threw up the apple, and when he had the heart in his hand, he was holding his heart.
Like, yeah, holding his heart in his hand, right? Obviously, the blatant symbolism is this is a heart. It represents my love, my emotions, my feelings towards someone else. The heart in this character, the character of the heart, is this very, very cute little thing, all dewy-eyed, and, tries to kiss him when he reaches out, tries to kiss him, right? Brushes his hair. Something that we as... When we get to the biblical end, we start looking at these components, and I want you to notice all the components of this are physical for the heart. Hey. All of the heart's things that it does are all about the physical. Granted, it's a short film. You can't communicate everything, and they decided to make it a one with no dialogue. So what component did they use very effectively in the background?
Music.
If you'd watch that without the music going, with the slow piano, the violin playing when all the people are judging them, don't have nearly the same emotional response, right? Objectively speaking, if you don't have the biblical grounding where you say there's something objectively wrong about a homosexual relationship, you just watch that film, it's very emotionally compelling. It's like, what's so wrong about this? It's just two people who like each other.
One thing I found interesting is that if you took the two actual characters out of the equation and just showed the hearts like they did, the hearts are very non-sex specific. Like, they just look like little cartoon characters. Like, well, love is love regardless of who you are.
There you go. And
so why put a boundary around it? I feel like they were trying to get at something like that.
And I would say that's probably the main point of this short film. The main point of the main idea is love is love.
And it's physical.
Yeah, and it's physical. They probably don't intend that. It's just
that's just their
worldview.
That's because it's not a choice.
Yeah, that's the worldview of the people who made this, though. Is love is intrinsically physical and sexual? So, those are the other. I mean, again, one of the pieces of symbolism where they're really using components to get their point across. One, the music. Look at the lighting difference. Here. All
it's
of these
so
scenes.
Dark with the other kids.
Correct. Right? You come
like
in here.
They're in the light.
We hit sepia tones.
We know.
We've got dark shadows. And when we see these kids, we've got the shading around the corners. They're all frowning. And camera angles in this one, too. You see the camera angle looking at these kids. If you were
they're
to imagine, where's
above.
The camera? Where's
they're
the camera?
Down.
Yeah, they're looking down. These people who are... Looking down on these other people.
Also, the camera is lower to the ground when it's pinned. Looking at them, I think that's to make you feel like
on their level.
They're probably feeling very small.
Exactly. This is a very common filmmaking technique, by the way. The camera from the floor, first most effectively used in Orson Welles' the Rosebud movie. What movie am I thinking of? Citizen Kane. There's this famous scene where the Citizen Kane is this big guy, and he aggrandizes himself and has a political career, and the whole movie is about how he is such a powerful, intimidating man, and he ends up being quite unintimidating at the end. But at the time when he's the most powerful and the most intimidating, we got this shot where the camera's right on the floor. You can see everything, the floorboards up to him, and the other person is standing here, and he's just huge. And you've got this camera angle that is depicting that reality.
All my noses are turned up.
Yeah, I wouldn't put that one too far, because... But yes. And you guys have identified some of the main components, and you've done some pretty good biblical analysis right away of identifying what's wrong with them. The faulty assumptions that they're making. One, their definition of love. Love is not intrinsically physical. There's more to this issue that they're clearly addressing a particular social issue. Name it.
Homosexuality
and culture. There's more to this issue than gets depicted on this, and this is what's known as a straw man argument. Their argument is a straw man. There's more to a homosexual relationship than just feelings. And they even, I think unknowingly, recognize that. That it's all built on physical. Everything that the heart does, everything that that the boy does in relation to the other boy, it's all about the physical. It's not about spiritual.
Also,
until the very end, when we're saying there's no spiritual difference, what's wrong?
Also,
it's got two hearts that look the same. Yeah,
they didn't show any sort of build up to them actually talking and getting to know each other. It was just
this guy stalking another guy.
Yeah,
and
it's
heart
just
following him.
It's just a peeping Tom, right? It's a stalker.
Back to the Future.
Yeah. I've never understood that about most rom-coms, right? It's this guy who loves this girl from afar and stalks her, and he's so adorable. And what's the difference? The only difference seems to be between when he's adorable and when he's a creep is if the girl likes him or not.
Or
that seems to be it.
If she thinks he's cute and willing to give him a chance.
Yeah.
That
okay. Yeah, you guys did a good job. I want you guys. And I'm inclined to the same thing. You understood the message right away. We had to dig for some of the components, though. I want you to be able to identify the components that make up the message and show why those components might be built on faulty premises. That makes your arguments more effective, and it makes you more effective at analyzing movies, because sometimes you walk away from a movie going, there's just something off about that, I can't quite identify it. But if you think about the components in that movie, you might identify it. You might be able to figure out why it made you feel or think a certain way. Yeah.
What if we set something up for, once every month we have a movie night, we actually all sit down and we...
analyze a movie? I'd be down for that.
I think it'd be kind of fun. You can, cook out, bring the food in, and then watch the movie.
I would say, as I say to most of these suggestions, I will do my best to attend anything that you organize. I'm not going to take it on myself to organize it and rally it, though, because whenever I do that, it tends to fall apart. I know what I'm good at. I'm good at teaching, so I stick to that. I will support you in whatever way I can in making that happen. So you guys want to make that happen, I'm on board. Talk to Caleb.
Awesome.
Okay.
I don't want to do all that before the last week of October if we want to do it this month. Because Jared and I are going to New Orleans for our cousin's wedding.
That's one of those later planners.
Yeah. Last one, a scene from Frasier. Q5, day 6. I actually have to watch this while I'm in the truck. Yes, it's from the episode called Flower Child. I think I queued it up before we started. Let's see if it actually goes there. So there's one mildly inappropriate joke in here, so I apologize. I don't think it's... I ran it through my parent filter. I don't think it's bad enough that any parents would really strongly object, but just... it's actually something that we can analyze, though. So, what's happened so far, so to bring you up to date on where they are in the scene, they're the three... Oh, you can't see this. the three characters in the cab, Martin, Fraser, and Niles, are taking a cab ride. They're stuck in traffic, and the cab driver goes into labor. And so Niles has been up front, and he fails at successfully delivering the baby. And so Fraser gets up front, and he just embarrasses himself and fails. And so Martin is about to get up front and help deliver the baby.
I know, look, everything's going to be just fine, sweetheart. Now, I've delivered more than a few babies in my lifetime, and some of them are even older than you are now. Now, Fraser's going to hold your hand and help you with your breathing, and Niles is going to look out for an ambulance, and I'm going to get ready to bring beautiful baby into this world, okay?
Okay.
Good. Now, are there any questions?
Yet, our meter still be running.
She could tell she was
fine. Hello? Are you back yet?
This is the mildly inappropriate joke.
Well, go on. Turn your heads. Okay. So, I guess you have some excitement tonight.
No, I haven't.
Father Shaw made it sound exciting on the phone. Delivering a baby in a taxi.
Oh, that? I don't think of that as excitement as much as my sworn duty to use those skills I honed in medical school.
Miss Niles ran down to a falafel stand for a pot of hot water.
What I can't get over is that feeling of being there right when a person's life begins. One minute it's just this blob in some lady's stomach, next minute it's a person. Blob. Person.
Miracle of birth summed up in one poetic phrase.
And I'll bet you have some fond memories of when your son was born.
Oh, yes, of course. I remember the very first time I held him in my arms as a newborn. It was as if everything else in the universe simply melted away. There was just a father, a son, and the distant sound of Lilith saying, "If you ever come near me again, Fraser, I'll drop you with a deer rifle."
Okay, that was the scene I wanted to watch. Alright, this one is a little exercise, a little bit different, because we're not watching the whole episode. We're just watching a quick scene. But there's something in this scene that particularly... There's two things really that stand out to me. One in particular that strikes me as a biblical viewer that I'm wondering if it struck you. Anybody... There you go.
Yeah.
Right, it's a joke. 1 minute's a blob in a person's stomach, next minute's a person. Blob, person. The miracle of life summed up in one poetic phrase, right? And it's funny, haha, we laugh. That's the worldview that the makers of Fraser are trying to get you to accept. Right? Textbook. What? It's funny, right? Yeah, we all know life doesn't really begin until somebody comes out of the womb. Subpoint that they don't mention, and that they're probably... I've read up on lots of the writers of Fraser, and 99% of them would say, oh yeah, this is totally fine. We can kill those things. Before they're a person, they're just a blob. Right? This is the kind of thing I want you to be able to identify. This is the kind of thing that shapes worldviews and without you realizing. And that's how worldviews are shaped. Worldviews are largely shaped by culture and by art. By the things that you consume uncritically. And so what you have to do is consume them critically. Think about what you're watching. Think about what you're listening to, seeing. And ask yourself, is this true? Here. The other mild note that is really all throughout Fraser, it's the idea that Niles is the character who, you know, turned around and then turned back around to try and watch her undress, and Fraser turned him around again. All throughout the first 7 seasons of Fraser, he's leering at Daphne and fantasizing about her sexually from afar, and then gets a divorce from his current wife in order to marry her. And all of this is romantic and good because they're meant to be together because he loves her so much. Well, actually, Niles went through two different women to get to Daphne. He had an unhealthy attraction to her for a long time. It's completely physical. And there's no problem with this? No, we all just like the characters and we just get along.
And they let everything go along until Daphne was about to get married.
Yeah.
And then just left everyone.
Yeah. For the sake of drama. It's good television. It's horrible morality. And it's just presented as reality. This is okay because they really like each other. Well, that's not a good enough excuse. Some final thoughts. Questions that are tangentially related. I thought about devoting more time to, but I thought, no, we'll just get off track to do that, so I put them at the end. Actually, I'll go to this one first, and we'll come back to those questions, because we're nearly out of time anyway. But should I watch this movie? So, a lot of times, particularly in the development stages of life in Christianity, you're asking these questions of should I be watching this? Things like, should I be watching an R-rated movie? Should I be listening to explicit music? Is it right or wrong for Christians to do that? If I do that, am I sinning? These are questions that are very common, I think. And so I think this is a good general rule to go by. This is a good test. This is not straight out of the Bible, but I think it's wise. So the question is this. You ask yourself this series of questions. They should all have question marks, even though they all have periods. But does this movie weaken my reason, impair the tenderness of my conscience, obscure my sight of God, diminish my thirst for spiritual things, or increase the authority of my body over my mind? If you answer yes to any of those five questions, you probably should not consume or watch this movie. And it applies to all art. Should I listen to this music? Should I view this painting? I think if you honestly ask yourself those questions, then the answer should come back no. Don't, and it comes back yes, then your action should be no, I'm not going to watch this for the sake of whatever prohibited. Yeah.
Define tenderness of conscience.
Yeah. Does it make you cynical, or does it obscure your view of right and wrong? Does it make you justify bad action as a result?
Or does it desensitize you to such things?
Does it desensitize you to such things? Yeah, I think that'd be a good.
Yeah, that seems more like an opposite comparison to tenderness.
Yeah. Tell you, this is the reason why I ended up closing my eyes through half of the movie Deadpool, and I will never watch that movie again because it did that. It did that, and it did that. There were just so many little things in there that were just like... And that's a personal thing. I would argue that I think that movie was so blatant, I don't think any Christians should really watch and enjoy it, the same way I don't think any Christians should watch and enjoy porn. So that's practically what that movie was. But I'm open to arguments against it. But anyway. I think that's a good litmus test. Rule of thumb to go by, like I said, it's by no means biblical or binding on all Christians, but it's a good personal assessment for how should I behave, not how should he behave. This is all. Most of these, should someone do this, it's better to ask it of yourself than to ask it of your neighbor, because when you start asking it of your neighbor, then you get into a realm of comparison and judgment that is unhealthy. I digress there. Related to that, though, should Christians watch or support R-rated movies containing violence, foul language, and sex? I think this is a good question to ask. Is it right for Christians to support such movies? And I would argue, quite often, the answer may be yes. It is right for Christians to support and view and consume movies that contain those things. The question is, how are they presented? What is the message or point being made with those things? Is it sex for the sake of sex? Is it just to show, is it just to arouse, is it in there intended just to increase the authority of the viewer's body over his mind? Or is it in there to make a point? Is it in there to make a point about the fact that sex is a spiritual, transcendental relation that knits two souls together, as designed by God? Same thing with violence. Is it there to show that violence is a real thing that actually exists in the world that has to be dealt with and accounted for? Is it treating evil violence as evil? I think a movie that accurately depicts evil as evil is probably an okay movie to consume, assuming that you personally aren't affected by it on another level. If viewing graphic evil violence does some of these things to you, I'd say it's probably not best for you to watch or support that movie. It doesn't necessarily make it wrong. It's a question of what point are they making. This is a view that I think many in the church would disagree with me and push back on, and I'm fine with that. I can get along with Christians who say that we shouldn't support R-rated and violent movies if they can get along with me. We'll just agree to disagree on this point. I think some of you in here share my feelings because we've talked about it previously. But I do think those of you who are inclined to be on the more... of course Christians should be able to support and consume R-rated material and graphic and violent or sexual or foul-mouthed material. You should take another step back and make sure what's its purpose in that thing.
Ask yourself why.
Is there a reason? Or is it just to revel in the gritty grossness of it? In which case, it's usually probably a bad thing.
And support isn't like supporting those things in the movie. It's supporting movies that may contain those things.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, exactly. It's not necessarily saying, yes, let's get more violence in there. Example of this that I point to sometimes is The Patriot. Patriot was my first R-rated movie.
That's the first one I thought of.
Yeah. It is violent, graphically so, in a few particular scenes. But it makes a very good point with the violence. It's showing, first of all, the horrendous violence of what the Revolutionary War was like. And it also... In one particularly violent scene where the main character goes and slays a whole bunch of British soldiers who just kidnapped his son, and they're taking him to be killed, right after they killed his other son, it's talking about the power of love and what's necessary to protect those you love, which is definitely reflected in the Godhead. And what Jesus is going to do when he returns for the sake of those he loves really mirrors that scene pretty accurately.
That was my first favorite in the movie, too. I think it was actually... more well done than like Braveheart.
Yeah, I agree. Another one that people point to, kind of on that point, is Saving Private Ryan.
That was my first.
Opening scene of that movie is graphic. It is hard to get through. It is violent. But the purpose of that violence is to show just how awful D-Day was. There is, I think, a question can we show just how awful it was without being quite so disgusting?
Like the end of 13 Reasons Why.
Yeah, like the end of 13 Reasons Why. If you guys watch that show, which I don't recommend, it wasn't that great of a show, but if you do, watch it with your goggles on. But it was just like unnecessarily graphic to make a point that really didn't need to be made. But I digress. I'd love to talk more, if you disagree with that assessment of 13 Reasons Why, I'd love to talk more about why I disapprove of it. What is the difference between a good movie and an effective movie? I think this is a question that should be asked. An effective movie, I think, would be like the short film that we watched in a heartbeat. I think that was a very effective movie. They
effectively like got their point across,
exactly.
Whether it was right or wrong.
And it's very compelling to people who watch it. Lots of people watch that movie and are persuaded towards the homosexual agenda because of it. Because it was a very effective movie. Doesn't mean it was a good movie. A good movie is an effective movie that promotes truth.
A movie that effectively promotes good morality.
Yeah. How should Christians talk about the movies they watch? I think this is a...
With extreme criticism.
criticism in the non-emotional sense of that word.
Like, yes.
Like analyzing it and identifying its components and making judgments on whether or not they are biblical or non-biblical. And also with a degree of humility. There's we saw it displayed in here, and I'm guilty of it quite often, of being quite dismissive towards people of different views and towards movies that promote different views. And I'm against that as Christians purely on the basis of effectiveness. Being dismissive of something without giving reasons is not as effective in convincing someone that they're wrong as being more kind and compassionate or tactful and giving the reasons. Dismissiveness to a degree, but not to such a degree that it cuts off the lines of communication between someone who you disagree with. So, example again with that In a Heartbeat movie. When we first analyze more gay propaganda, the idiots can't believe they can't see it. Not as effective as saying, have you thought about some of the components of this movie that might not be accurate? Let's talk about whether or not love is a physical thing or if there's a spiritual component and what that spiritual component is. I think this movie wasn't that good because it doesn't accurately represent reality. That's more, someone who disagrees with you about that movie will be more inclined to listen if you approach it that way. So I think Christians should talk about the movies I watch with a bit of tact. It's something I'm very guilty of, and I have to work at, of not being tactful in the way that I express my views. And I would say many of the people in here are also guilty of. So, just a little check for us all. Any other final thoughts? I know I'm over time. I figured you guys didn't care too much.
Okay. Batman scene.
You guys want to watch the Batman scene?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good
movie. See if I can find it. Actually, you know what? I think I have the movie. I don't think I deleted that one.
Give me a call when you want.
Oh, that's such a good scene. Oh, that's so funny.
Okay.
You're a hard man to reach.
Watch this shot.
Lao's halfway to Hong Kong. You asked. I could have taken his passport. I told you to keep me in the loop.
All that was left in the vaults for a month. They knew we were coming. As soon as your office got involved,
my office. You're sitting down there with scum like Wirtz and Ramirez, and you're talking. Oh, yeah, Gordon. I almost had your rookie cold on a racketeering beat.
Don't try and clap the fact that clearly Maroney's got people in your office, Dent.
We need Lao back. But the Chinese won't extradite a national under any circumstances.
If I get him to you, and you get him to Tom, I'll get him to sink.
We're going after the mob's life savings.
See, that sign is like it starts out far away, it gets closer, it's bringing them together, and it's like this weird like third party that's watching the conversation, and you're like something is tense about this scene, and it's the fact that they did that shot that way. Anyway,
thanks.
I think my connection is starting to slow down again. This is one of my favorite movies of all time. Christopher Nolan is my favorite director. So.